calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, my, so much radical truth-telling over the weekend, it's hard to know where to begin. First of all, protests across the country. Now, it's interesting. The article I read in the Wall Street, in the New York Times, I was in Michigan over the weekend. I'm back now in what George Herbert Walker Bush used to refer to as Little Beirut, also known as the People's Republic of Portland, Oregon. And reading the Times, the Sunday Times, you kind of got the impression that not a lot of people were showing up for the anti-war protests and things over the weekend. But, you know, the bottom line, here's my take on this. And for example, here in Portland, we had about 10,000 people show up. None of these numbers across the country were anything close to what they were 3 years ago. Not even close. And there are folks who are saying, well, you know, it's this means that the anti-war movement is dead, bloody, bloody. No, I'm sorry. It hasn't happened. It's not like that at all. It is they have become us. It was like there was a time when it was like, oh, look at those people with long hair. And then remember the 70s? And Newt Gingrich had long hair? I mean, everybody had long hair. Not necessarily, you know, the hair down to their shoulders or something, but you know, they all had long hair. So anyhow, they have become us, and so that's my take on what's going on. And so we'll carry it on from there. Colin Hanna's with us. He's the president of WeNeedOffense.com. WeNeedOffense.com, the website. Colin, welcome to the program.
Hey Tom, thank you.
Hey Colin, We Need Offense, where and why?
Across the U.S. Southern border, in order to secure the border, not to close the border, Tom, but to secure the border from the rising tide of illegal immigration, which now exceeds 100,000 a month and does not consist entirely of people coming here to try to find a better life or a better way. There's at least four other dimensions to the problem, including drug trafficking and associated crime, human trafficking, national security threat, and a public health threat. And for all of those reasons, a fence combined with an adequate complement of Border Patrol agents is an essential component, not the only component, but an essential component in a comprehensive immigration reform effort.
Well, let's look this over here, Colin Hanna.
Sure.
We know that into the United States every year we have literally hundreds of tons of cocaine, of heroin, of methamphetamine now coming from Asia. Coming into the United States, we know that there are many thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of illegal immigrants who are arriving in the United States, all not through the Mexican border.
Correct.
And, I mean, you can walk into any neighborhood in any big city and you can buy drugs that were not grown in the United States, did not originate in the United States. And
so offenses, your point is what?
Offense is not going to stop any of that.
Offense is not going to stop any of that other. But it certainly is going to have an impact on illegal immigration across the southern border. Let me give you an interesting...
I agree with you. No, Colin, you and I agree on that, and you don't need to convince me. The point that I'm making is that by talking about this as a security issue, and I agree that there's some dimension of it that is legitimate with regard to security, but nonetheless, you know, or as a drug interdiction issue or things like that, you're really downplaying your and my real concern here, although you and I have different solutions. You think we need a fence. I think we need a national industrial policy, and that we need to put into jail people who hire illegals. But in any case, really what you're talking about is let's stop all the illegal immigration to the United States, particularly people who are coming here looking for work. Is that not true?
No. Let me give you an interesting statistic. If you talk about other than Mexican illegal immigration apprehensions, and of course that's all you can measure. You can't measure the people who get away. You can only measure the people who get caught. If you take Mexican immigration out of it altogether and you simply look at other than Mexican illegal immigration, 94% of the total is across the U.S.-Mexican border.
Sure.
So,
sure, of course. Now, but here's the larger question, Colin, and that is, why are those people coming here?
Many of them are coming here to escape the grinding poverty of their native land and to plug into the greatest economy that the world has ever known.
They're coming here for work, in other words.
Absolutely.
Sure. So this is, you know, now here's the question, Colin Hanna, of WeNeedAFence.com. Why didn't we need a fence in 1950?
Because we didn't have the flood that we have now.
But there were 100 million people in Mexico in 1950. There were you know, half a billion people in Central and South America. And grinding poverty was even worse in South and Central America. The reason why we didn't need a fence in 1950 was because 35% of the American workforce was unionized. 70% of Americans could raise a family, have a pension, have health care, take a vacation, put their kids through college on one paycheck. And because we had such a strong middle class in America, the barriers to the entry to the workplace were substantial. It was against the law to hire illegals in 1950, and those laws were enforced. Now we've had conservatives come along for the last 25 years, ever since Ronald Reagan, and say, oh, what's more important than protecting our borders? What's more important than protecting our American workforce? What's more important than protecting the American middle class is protecting the profits of big corporations.
Well, that's not the viewpoint of this conservative, number one. Number two, there are.
Well, then why don't you advocate a law that would put into prison the CEO of any corporation that hires illegals? Because if you did that, not only would you not need a fence, you'd have to tear down the fence that you're trying to build to get those, because those, you'd have 11 million people trying to stampede out of the United States back into Mexico.
Absolutely to the contrary. Here's the point. I agree with you that we need to have serious workplace enforcement of employee documentation rules. That's absolutely essential, and companies should indeed face serious sanctions if they violate those. So on that point, we're in full agreement. But even if you were able to address the matter of illegal economic immigrants, you will have done nothing about those other four levels of illegal immigration that I pointed out. And each one of those poses a serious threat to the United States.
I don't disagree with you on that regard, although I would suggest to you that, as I said before, those people are coming in right now in containers. I mean, we're opening containers randomly and finding them full of people from Asia, for example. They're coming in on our ships. They're coming in illegally on planes. They're swimming here. They're coming through the Canadian border. I mean, if people, for those other reasons, people who are bringing in drugs, people who intend us harm, criminals who are trying to get into our country, whether you've got a fence or not, they're going to figure out a way to get in. But the people who are you know, desperately climbing those fences and trying to get in the country, they're doing it because they're offered jobs in the United States. This is all about, really, Colin Hanna, I've got to say, what this is all about is that Reagan and Bush Sr. and Bill Clinton and Bush Jr., all of these four conservative presidents, all understood the law of supply and demand. When you increase the supply of something, the demand for it goes down, or rather the price of it goes down. You know, the demand is the same, but you've increased supply, and so price goes down. And that's true of labor as well. We've got 11 million, interesting coincidence, we have 11 million illegal people in the workforce in the United States, and we have about 11 million unemployed Americans. Now, if we were to actually start enforcing those laws, what would happen is, number one, those 11 million illegal workers in the United States would go home because there's nothing for them to do here. And number two, you'd see the rise of labor unions because labor would become harder to get, so the price would go up. You'd see the rise of, you wouldn't even need it to increase the minimum wage law. You'd see wages go up. You'd see us returning back to the golden age of the American middle class before Ronald Reagan started deconstructing the social safety net. And Reagan and Bush and Clinton and Bush started, you know, basically saying, hey, come on up here, we'll give you, you know, it was Reagan who gave everybody amnesty. Who started this thing?
You talk about the law of unintended consequences. No unintended consequence would surprise me more than
I think this was intended.
Our fence would somehow increase unionization in the U.S. I don't think that would be the effect at all.
Well, it probably wouldn't, because your fence would probably keep in the 11 million illegals who are already here.
In any case, we can agree on the importance of workplace enforcement, and that will definitely have an impact. But
see, most of your conservative friends don't agree with you on that, Colin Hanna.
That's why we need a fence. Even though we have a provocative name of WeNeedAFence.com, we're actually plowing new ground on this issue, Tom. We just completed a survey which shows that if you combine a fence, and when I say a fence, I'm talking about a high-tech, state-of-the-art border security system, not something that you go down to Home Depot and buy. If you combine that with a program of temporary worker and existing illegal alien regularization, you actually develop more total support for that combination plan than the basic support for
right,
either.
You're back to my thing that the conservatives are all saying, we need to have a certain number of these people here because we need an underclass so we can keep wages low in America.
Well, that's not my argument at all, and you know that.
Well, I think that that's the effect of it. I suggest you give it some thought. Colin Hanna, and for our listeners who want to learn more about it, go to WeNeedOffense.com. You can make up your own mind. Colin, thanks a lot for being with us this morning. Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Not long ago in America, the nation's heartbeat throbbed. United, not divided. Families only needed one job. Most could afford a baseball game, hot dog and a beer. Vacation in the summer, and a few new clothes each year. Big MacDonald had a farm. Then he opened a burger joint. We've drowned in fat ever since. Yeah, there really ain't no point. Tipped beyond measure. We keep coming back for more. Now the justice scale lies broken all over the global floor.
And welcome back, my friends. 22 minutes past the hour at the Tom Hartman radio program. Let's see. In Ohio, there's still some 100,000 votes that haven't been counted from the 2004 election. We've discovered over 300,000 people in districts that vote anywhere from 60 to 90% Democratic. Over 300,000 people were thrown off the voting rolls in the months and weeks leading up to the 2004 election. So when they showed up, they couldn't vote. People had to stand in line for 9-10 hours. Whether or not the voting machines were rigged, even without that, it's quite obvious that the Ohio election was stolen in 2004. We know that in Florida now, in 2002, we learned that the vote in 2000 in Florida, this was in the New York Times and the Washington Post, you know, the consortium of news agencies went down and actually counted the ballots. We know that Al Gore actually got more votes, if you counted the whole state of Florida, than did George W. Bush, and yet he got to become president. Because of a couple of people that his daddy appointed, and then his daddy's, boss, Ronald Reagan, appointed to the Supreme Court. And if you think Reagan was really running the White House when he had Alzheimer's in his final days, I got a bridge to sell you. So, you know, Daddy Bush set up the Supreme Court that installed Junior as president. And given all that today, the headline from from Forbes, White House calls for new Belarus vote. Now, you know, I'm no fan of Lukashenko. I've been through Belarus, going through Belarus. I'm only in transit. You get on a train, as I recall, we got on the train in Hungary or Poland, and ended up in Latvia, Lithuania. I don't remember how I transited Belarus now, but I did. And I remember when we entered the country, the train had to stop, and all these guards got on with these German shepherds, and they had machine guns, and they walked up and down the aisles. And if you pulled out a camera to take pictures out the window, they would arrest you. And it was a scary, scary thing. And they're checking everybody's passport and writing down who's there. And then when the train leaves the country, the guards get off at that end, and they get on the next train going through the next way. And, you know, it's a repressive police state. Yes. And the guy who's the leader, you know, wins with some 80-90% of some incredible vote. And but I just find, you know, this pot calling the kettle black stuff just strange. I don't know how to describe it. Strange. Coming up on today's program, by the way, the third anniversary of the Iraq War. Julia Whitty says we've pushed the seas to the brink. Our labor news with Alec DeBrow. Those will be in the next 2 hours. And our quote for the day from Thomas Jefferson. Were it left to me to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, I should not hesitate a moment to prefer the latter. Now, as I was saying, a lot happened over the weekend. We talked briefly about the anti-war protests that we saw all across the United States. Congressman Dennis Kucinich recently on the floor of the House of Representatives saying what most of us have been saying for the better part of 3 years, 4 years. I don't know why more people are not saying this out loud. Certainly it would have happened had Bill Clinton been president when 9/11 happened. The Republicans would have been screaming, this happened on his watch, the largest failure of security in the history, and he knew it was happening. And rather, you would have. Can you imagine if 9/11 happened when Clinton and Gore were president? Man, well, Dennis Kucinich finally, well, not finally, he's been speaking out for some time, but now on the floor of the House.
Before I call the attention of the House, the juxtaposition of two news stories. One that says, relating to 9/11, it says federal officials were repeatedly warned in the months before the September 11, 2001 terror attacks that Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda were planning aircraft hijacking and suicide attacks, according to a new report that the Bush administration has been suppressing. And this, from the front page of today's Washington Post, a newly leaked video recording the high-level government deliberation the day before Hurricane Katrina hit, shows disaster officials emphatically warning President Bush that the storm posed a catastrophic threat to New Orleans and the Gulf Coast, and a grim-faced Bush personally assuring state leaders that his administration was fully prepared, quote-unquote, to help. Do we see a pattern here? 9/11, Katrina, they knew something was going to happen and they didn't act. They knew that if they went into Iraq, that we were looking at a disaster, that there was no way we were going to be able to run that country. They know that global climate change poses a threat to the entire planet. Nothing's being done. A pattern of recklessness, indifference, callousness. The implications are deadly for the people of the United States.
The United States. And I would add, they know that the bird flu may well be coming, and they're doing virtually nothing about that. We get to see one of the big drug companies that's making millions and millions and millions of dollars in profits because they made it illegal for the federal government through the Medicare program to negotiate for drug prices, taking some of those billions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars in profits, and running ads on TV going, ah, we're working on a bird flu vaccine. We'll figure this thing out. Don't you worry. Corporations are going to solve everything. And meanwhile, what's Bush doing? He's riding his mountain bike. I don't know. I sometimes think he's fallen down on his head too many times. Other times, I'm more inclined to agree with Justin Frank that he just done drank too much. Got to tell you what's happening in Iraq right after this. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Bring them back from Iraq, cause they never should have wandered. We're wrong all along to Iraq. And the price we'll pay is high there, they shouldn't have to die there. Bring them back from Iraq, bring them back.
And welcome back, my friends. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. Tom Hartman here with you. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, 34 minutes past the hour. Boston Legal. This is incredible. An ABC television program. And I'm surprised that the right-wingers are just not out there just, you know, twisting their panties into a wad. But odds are they don't want to draw attention to it. So I will. Boston Legal. This is the storyline. There's a woman who is refusing to pay part of her income taxes, her federal income taxes, because it goes to support the war machine, which is invading Iraq. And so here is her defense attorney in court talking about this.
When the weapons of mass destruction thing turned out not to be true, I expected the American people to rise up. They didn't. Then, when the Abu Ghraib torture thing surfaced and it was revealed that our government participated in rendition, a practice where we kidnap people and turn them over to regimes who specialize in torture, I was sure then the American people would be heard from. We stood mute. Then came the news that we jailed thousands of so-called terrorist suspects, locked them up without the right to a trial or even the right to confront their accusers. Certainly, we would never stand for that. We did. And now it's been discovered the executive branch has been conducting massive illegal domestic surveillance on its own citizens, you and me. And I at least consoled myself that finally, finally, the American people will have had enough. Evidently, we haven't. In fact, if the people of this country have spoken the messages, we're okay with it all. Torture, warrantless search and seizures, illegal wiretappings, prison without a fair trial, or any trial, war on false pretenses, we as a citizenry are apparently not offended. There are no demonstrations on college campuses. In fact, there's no clear indication that young people even seem to notice.
This is from Boston Legal, from the ABC Network television program. Amazing. Absolutely amazing. Why does construction continue? I just have to share this with you. This is incredible. Why does construction continue on huge and obviously permanent military bases in Iraq? You've heard about how the reconstruction is not going well. It's not going according to plan. It's not going as fast as everybody wants, blah, 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 blah. Well, it turns out that actually there are some construction programs in Iraq that are going just fine, thank you very much. For example, the U.S. so-called embassy. It's really the second world headquarters for the American Empire. This is a self-sustaining cluster, 21 buildings, reinforced 2.5 times the usual standard, some walls as thick as 15 feet. It will house over 1,000 U.S., what we call government officials, not just offices, but living spaces, a gym, swimming pool, barber and beauty shops, food court, commissary, large-scale barracks for troops to protect them, a school, locker rooms, warehouse, vehicle maintenance garage, 6 apartment buildings with a total of 619 one-bedroom apartments. Their water, electricity, and sewage treatment plants, all independent from the city of Baghdad, which is where it's located. Now, this is huge. And by the way, it's being constructed right on time. And then there are the permanent military bases. This, by the way, an article Richard Clark sent me. The permanent military bases. Camp Anaconda, for example, near Ballard. You ever heard of this? Odds are you have. I haven't. It occupies 15 square miles of Iraq. 15 square miles is a lot of territory. The base boasts 2 swimming pools, a gym, a mini golf course, first-run movie theater, 20,000 soldiers, less than 1,000 of whom ever leave the base. They can inspect new iPod accessories in one of the 2 base exchanges, which have piles of the latest electronics, racks of CDs to choose from. One of the PX managers recently boasted that every day he was selling 15 TVs to soldiers. At Camp Anaconda, located in Salahuddin province, where resistance is fierce, the occupation forces live in air-conditioned units, where plans are being drawn up to run internet, cable TV, and overseas telephone access to them. Then there's KBR land. It's where thousands of civilian contractors live on the base, this on the same base, Camp Anaconda. They have a hospital where 400 surgeries a month are carried out. If troops aren't up for the rather lavish dinners served by third country nationals from India, Nepal, Sri Lanka, and Bangladesh who work for slave wages, they can visit Burger King, Pizza Hut, Popeyes, or Subway and wash it down with a mocha from Starbucks. There's Camp Victory near the Baghdad airport, which is one of the largest overseas bases ever built since the war in Vietnam. Adjacent to Camp Victory, soldiers can even compete in their own triathlons. It's over a 140-mile course. Richard Clark writes, Mr. Bush refuses to set a timetable for withdrawal from Iraq because he doesn't intend to withdraw. We're building 4 of these bases right now, and they are all on schedule, on budget, and going very well and being occupied very well. So we'll see how this all plays out. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Matt in Salt Lake City, Utah. Hey, Matt, welcome to the program. Matt? Alex, okay, Matt, if you can't hear me, you must be listening to your radio or to your radio instead of your phone. I'm going to put you on hold. And we will try another caller. Let's go to Doc in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Hey, Doc, how you doing?
Hey, Tom. Good morning.
Good morning.
You are truly a voice of the people, and it's such an honor to speak to you.
Well, thank you, Doc. I do my best. It's all any of us can do, you know?
Well, let me tell you, you do it above shoulder, and it's I'm elated to have you on the radio. As a matter of fact, I used to be a registered Republican, and because of you, I switched over to the Democratic side.
Well, good on you, Doc.
I used to be one of those parrots for Rush Limbaugh. The only thing that could come out of my mouth is what he repeated. And that's what I stood up for.
You know what's amazing, Doc, is when he says that stuff and it sounds so appealing. You know, it sounds so common sense. And until you dig one level deeper and you discover what's behind it and why it's being said.
It's all dressings and show.
Yeah, yeah.
That's all what it is.
But that's not what you called about.
Listen, the reason why I called was you had Congressman Sanders on last week.
Yeah. We have him on every Friday. Have for 2 years now.
Okay, particularly last week. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about he had a mandate from his constituents in regards to impeachment. He took the opposite course because he wants to focus on the reelection.
No, actually, that's a bit of a mischaracterization. There were five towns in Vermont that voted to ask Bernie to participate with or initiate some sort of impeachment proceedings against Bush. What Bernie did, he said that, you know, he could write a bill that says let's impeach Bush and introduce it tomorrow, and it would just vanish. It would fall into the black hole. So instead, what he did was he signed on with John Conyers, who's actually getting some momentum on this thing, on House Resolution 635. Which calls for an investigation which will determine whether or not impeachable offenses have been committed. Now, this is exactly the same thing John Conyers did with Richard Nixon a year before Nixon was impeached.
Right.
So this is really the thing to do.
This leads to question. Well, you see, that's the whole point. This is question one. To me, when you get 70% of the people speaking, to me, that's telling our representatives, we're giving them a mandate.
I agree.
We're essentially giving them an order saying this is what we want. 70%, and irregardless, I think, of where our leaders are, they should honor that mandate, even though they object to it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in retrospect, he's right, and that's something we should focus on. But I think where the Dems are falling gravely ill is a two-prong attack. It's like they're taking one step at a time. I think we need to focus on the old six elections and continue, for lack of a better term, the bombardment on what Bush is doing.
I agree. It worked for the Republicans. And the fact of the matter is, John Conyers has 31 people, maybe 32 now, who've signed on to his resolution. There are over 200 Democrats in the House of Representatives. So,
right.
You know, where are the rest of them? And that's where I encourage you, Doc, and everybody else to call toll-free to your member of Congress, 1-888-355-3588, and say, please join with and sign on to Congressman Conyers' resolution, House Resolution 635, to look into the crimes of the Bush administration. Much appreciated. Matt in Salt Lake. Hey, Matt, you still there?
I am.
Okay, what's up? We got about a minute.
The clip you played from Boston Legal, it's kind of coincidental. We watched it on TiVo last night, and my wife woke up this morning. She goes, gosh, that's exactly how I feel about what has happened. I can't imagine how all of these things could have gone down and continue. People continue to ignore them.
Yeah.
It's just astonishing, and that show, by the way, is awesome and needs more press, and I think the conservatives avoid commenting on it for that exact reason.
Yeah, that's interesting. I've never seen it. We got the clip off a website that I don't know if it was Media Matters or Crooks and Liars. It was one of those websites, and I thought, this is amazing. This is on network television. So.
James Spader, by the way, was a character that you played, and he does a phenomenal job. It's a great show. I'm one of the executive producers. I'm really not. I'm just kidding with you.
Yeah, okay.
It's a great show, but kudos to you for playing it and keeping people's awareness. Thank you.
There you go. Thanks a lot, Matt. Thanks for listening to us there in Salt Lake City on, I'm assuming, on Sirius Satellite Radio. Great to hear from you. It's 45 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the radio support group of, by, and for we, the people of the United States of America.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
With your guns and drums and guns, hooroo, with your guns and drums and guns, hooroo, with your guns and drums and guns, the enemy nearly slew you. My darling dear, you look so queer. Johnny, I hardly knew you.
And welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Got some clips. We'll play them in the next hour or the hour after that. We'll get to them as the program goes on. Dick Durbin on Feingold, Jack Murtha. I shared with you Dennis Kucinich. Lest we forget, probably the most important one. Today, of course, the third anniversary. It's the first day of spring. It's the vernal equinox, celebrated by pagans worldwide. But it's also the day that it's also the anniversary of the third anniversary of the bombing, the commencement of the war against Iraq.
As a condition for ending the Persian Gulf War, the Iraqi regime was required to destroy its weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah, and they did.
To cease all development of such weapons.
Yeah, and they stopped.
And to stop all support for terrorist groups.
Well, mostly.
The Iraqi regime has violated all of those obligations.
Yeah, right.
It possesses and produces chemical and biological weapons. It is seeking nuclear weapons.
Yeah, and we found out now that it was all lies. And, you know, it's just, it's like, well, here, another one. You'll recall that the UN sent inspectors into Iraq, and the inspectors were there up until the day before the bombing started when Bush recalled them. Because the UN didn't recall them, because the UN didn't authorize us to attack Iraq. In fact, Resolution 1441 specifically said that we couldn't attack Iraq until Hans Blix or Mohammed al-Baradei certified that Iraq was in noncompliance. They never made that certification. But nonetheless, we pulled the inspectors out. That's not, though, how George remembers.
The larger point is, and the fundamental question is, does Saddam Hussein have a weapons program? And the answer is absolutely. And we gave him a chance to allow the inspectors in, and he wouldn't let them in.
What?
And therefore, after a reasonable request, we decided to remove him from power along with other nations so as to make sure he was not a threat to the United States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if you believe that, I got a bridge to sell you. Mike in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind?
Hey, I wanted to talk to you about what your comments you were making about the Burger King and the PX and all that that's being put over in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
I spent 9 months.
I was just reading from a news report here, Mike.
Well, you had a kind of sarcasm like it's wrong. Well, I spent 9 months in Bosnia, and we had the same deals over there, and that was under the Clinton administration.
I agree.
I didn't hear anybody yelling and screaming about, you know, that's a waste of money, we shouldn't be doing this or that.
Well, we went into Bosnia, as I recall, and I may be wrong on this because I don't pretend to be a scholar of the Bosnian conflict. And by the way, the article I read to you notes that the base that's being built is the second largest in the world behind the one in Bosnia. We went into Bosnia with the rest of NATO, did we not?
Well, after the UN got their butts handed to them and they came crawling on their hands and knees begging for us.
Right. Yeah. I'm not disagreeing with you. I mean, as I said, I don't recall, you know, at the time I was not, you know, super aware of everything that was going on. I just remember watching day after day the shelling of Sarajevo and, you know, the murder of civilians. And I think there was a point at which we and the rest of the world said is enough. That is quite a different thing, frankly. I mean, do you know how many American soldiers died in Bosnia in the conflict?
I honestly have no idea.
I'm pretty sure it's fewer than 20. I may be wrong, but it's certainly fewer than 100. And, you know, it's night and day. It's a completely different thing. Bosnia did not have resources that we wanted. We had a coalition of countries. There was a broad consensus. Well, you know, as I said, I can't speak as a scholar of the Bosnian conflict. But just because we built a military base in Bosnia, and it's, you know, a large one and it's well occupied, doesn't mean that we should be in Iraq at the same time that President Bush is saying on television that it's his intention ultimately to leave Iraq. See, he is saying out of one side of his mouth, we're going to turn this over to the Iraqis as soon as they can stand up. And on the other hand, we are building in Iraq bases that the second largest American base in the world. What's wrong with this picture?
I'm going to tell you like this. The war in Iraq, I mean, I have mixed feelings on the whole ordeal. At least Bush is going on television, you know, giving us a statement. Going to Bosnia, I don't ever remember hearing a statement from Clinton. As a matter of fact, I didn't know anything about Bosnia until I raise my hand and said I do. I get to Fort Hood. 2 months later, I'm on my way over there. I don't know why. I don't know what the hell is going on. All I know is I'm over there defending people that want to kill each other.
Yeah. Well, Mike,
I'm not being told why.
Mike, I'm not defending Bill Clinton. I, you know, there's a lot of areas where I won't defend Bill Clinton. And frankly, as I said, I can't speak to Bosnia. This is not about Bosnia. This is about what's going on in Iraq.
You're absolutely right about that. But I guess one of my biggest hardships with the whole deal is that I kind of hold a grudge against the war protesters now, because I didn't see them holding signs and wearing out shoes, marching around trying to bring us back home. So, you know, I kind of have hard feelings towards them.
You wanted
and
to be.
I don't expect anybody to understand that, unless they actually went on a deployment where the American people didn't speak up about it or against it.
Well, I don't think that there was a broad consensus in America that going into Bosnia to stop ethnic cleansing was a bad thing. I mean, I may be wrong, but I don't think that there was. I don't think that, you know, half of Americans thought that it was a bad idea. 55% of Americans, the day that Bush attacked Iraq, said in polls that we shouldn't attack Iraq, that they didn't represent a threat to us.
Yeah, I mean, I look at the whole Iraq war like this. When Bush said it was weapons of mass destruction, I honestly believe that one of the main weapon of mass destruction was Saddam Hussein. Now, as far as getting us out of there and handling the situation, Bush is dropping the ball. I mean, I cannot defend him on that.
I'm with you, Mike. Mike, we're out of time, but thanks for the call. I appreciate it.
Good,
and thanks for listening to the program. Yeah, I don't disagree that Bush is dropping the ball. I don't. Saddam Hussein, he's almost 70 years old. You know, I mean, actually, he was over 70 when we took him out. I just don't think he was a threat. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friend. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. Julia Whitty has a new article out. She's a contributing writer for Mother Jones Magazine, motherjones.com. New article out titled, The Fate of the Ocean. Julia, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Great to have you with us here. What is the state of the oceans worldwide?
Well, it's not good right now. There's a lot we're doing to the oceans on every front. We're kind of attacking them on all sides, and most of this goes on out of sight of us living on land, so that most of us aren't even aware of what's happening. If we were doing to the land what we're doing to the ocean, there'd be a huge uproar, but most of it goes unseen.
And what is it that we're doing to the ocean?
We're attacking from a variety of fronts. Let's start with fishing. We have modern industrialized fisheries that indiscriminately take life out of the ocean, so that the world fish catch, about 25% of that per year is species that we don't eat, or there's fish that are too small and we don't eat them. 25% of the annual world fish catch is thrown overboard dead or dying. That amounts to about 88 billion pounds of fish a year. That's B as in Bravo. We couldn't sustain that on the land, and neither can the oceans.
So are we running out of fish?
We are running out of fish. A study that came out of Nova Scotia, which was a really seminal study, there had always been an assumption within fisheries management that there were still lots of big fish out there in the ocean, the big tunas, the big swordfish, the big sharks and things like that. This study determined that, in fact, more than 90% of those big fish are gone. They are completely gone. There are no more big fish in the ocean. And the few that are left are tending to be captured smaller and smaller, frequently before they've even reached sexual maturity and can breed. Obviously, this is a very short-sighted policy.
Are they gone because their food supply is gone, because we're competing with them for food, or are they gone because we're taking them out?
It's because, for the most part, we're collecting them, and because these modern industrialized fisheries are indiscriminate, even if we don't eat so many of them, say, some of the shark species, we don't even eat them, but they get caught on the long lines in the gill nets and in the trawl fisheries, and they are, you know, wiped out in that manner. Now, sharks and many of these big fish are slow breeders. Some sharks don't reach sexual maturity until 25 years old, and then they maybe only give birth to a litter of twins every 3 years. So you can imagine, just run the math on that one in your head. If you're taking out the adult breeding population and you aren't allowing other ones to grow up, you're going to end up with none of these animals eventually. And we're hitting that point in some species. There's currently the Gulf of Mexico oceanic white tips, once an extremely prevalent shark, is now 99% gone. It's effectively extinct.
We're talking with Julia Witte, her new article, The Fate of the Ocean and Mother Jones. Julia, you use an analogy or a metaphor or whatever the right word is, I can never keep them straight, about hunting lions.
Yes. Basically, this again goes back to, if we did on the land what we're doing in the sea, you know, there'd be such an uproar. So the way we take fish out of the sea, we hunt fish in the sea. Let's say we ate lions, and that's basically what we're eating when we eat tuna and swordfish. We're eating the lions of the sea.
We're eating the top predators.
The top predators. And in order to catch those, let's say we went to the savannas, and we threw a net around the whole savanna, and we dragged in every last living thing, all the wildebeest, all the gazelles, all the meerkats. We dragged all the vegetation out by the roots, and then we threw all that stuff away and ate a few lions. That's what we're doing in the ocean.
Tell me about dead zones.
Dead zones are a sad reality of the green revolution. They're a byproduct of using chemical fertilizers on the land. And as we make plants grow on the land, all those fertilizers wash downstream. They end up in the ocean. They end up on those coastal shelf regions that were the most productive fisheries in the ocean. But plant bloom in the ocean is not a good thing like it is on land. And it leads to a chain reaction of events that eventually ends up with huge areas that there is no oxygen in the water. So imagine you're in your office or you're in your car, and suddenly all the oxygen is sucked out of your world. Well, you will either try to get away or you'll die, and you don't have a lot of time to do that. So these dead zones are all over the mouths of rivers of the world where there's no oxygen in the water. There's currently 150 dead zones on the planet, and the number of those is doubling every decade.
We're talking with Julia Witte. Her new article, The Fate of the Ocean in Mother Jones, is brilliant. At motherjones.com, you've got to read this thing. Julia, I think a lot of Americans assume that, you know, the law of supply and demand is the so-called law of supply and demand, is the canary in the mine shaft. It's the point, you know, that's the flag for them. You know, when the price of gasoline doubles in a three-year period, then people start looking around going, hey, maybe this stuff is getting in short supply, and you know, let's talk about peak oil. Whereas before that, nobody wanted to talk about peak oil. Why, if this is true, if the oceans are so badly to be depleted, if the fisheries are so exhausted, or if the fish are so exhausted, the quantities of fish, if there's so many dead zones around the world, why is fish still a relatively cheap food?
Well, I know in my lifetime it's become more and more expensive. It used to be a cheap food. It's really not anymore. But the truth is, once we wipe out one species, we just change the target and go after another. You look back in the past, and apparently there have been people who've been actually studying historical restaurant menus from the past, and they realize that in 19th century America, lobster, for instance, was snubbed as food for the poor because it was so incredibly abundant that poor people could just ate it all the time. Middle class people wouldn't touch this stuff. Obviously, that's changed. Now lobster's some of the most expensive food that you can eat. So our tastes change and abundance changes, and what we're willing to eat changes. So it creates a false sense of continuing abundance when in fact there isn't.
Now, what about the suggestion that if we just engage in intensive agriculture in the oceans the way we do in the Midwest, you know, with giant monoculture farms where we grow, you know, 100,000 acres of wheat or, you know, 500,000 acres of corn, why don't we just, you know, grow 1,000 acres or 5,000 acres of salmon, for example, in a giant fish farm? That'll solve all our problems.
Well, we do have fish farming underway, and sadly, it's not the fix it's supposed to be. To feed every 1 pound of farmed salmon that goes to market, 3 pounds of fish were taken out of the wild to feed that salmon. And as a result of the increase in farming or aquaculture of salmon and other fish right now, we're actually going out into the ocean and fishing new species that were completely pristine and completely untouched until we began to farm fish. And some of these are the basis of the food web, like krill. We're going out and collecting increasing amounts of krill to feed salmon, primarily for the purpose of when they eat krill, it turns their flesh a nice, desirable pink color. That's the main reason we're wiping out krill to feed salmon. So in addition to that, a lot of these farming operations happen in coastal areas that are heavily polluted. There's a lot of contaminants in many of these farmed fish. Farmed salmon from Scotland have been deemed so contaminated that people are advised to eat them only a handful of times a year.
Wow, contaminated by what?
Pretty much everything that comes out of our modern industrialized world. I mean, everything from fire retardant chemicals to PCBs, DDT, everything that we use, the thousands and thousands of chemical compounds that we create every single year, all of them eventually make their way to the ocean, and in many cases they stay there longer than they stay on the land.
Julia Whitty, we have a minute and a half or so. What can be done?
There are solutions to every one of these problems. In some cases, they're simple. The Gulf of Mexico dead zone, we need to minimize fertilizer applications by 12 to 14% a year, and we can drastically reduce the dead zone. Simple. Even all the global climate change issues, we know what to do. They're not that hard. We just won't do it. Fisheries, we know how to better manage fisheries than we're actually managing them right now. There are solutions to every one of these things. So far, we lack the political will. We seem to lack the maturity to tackle these true threats to homeland security.
And what happens if we do nothing?
The world as we know it will never be the same. And this is a world we evolved in. We evolved in a relatively stable time in the planet's history, and that isn't going to be in the future. We're going to be looking at major upheaval on every front, and it's not entirely clear how well we will fare under those conditions.
Do you see any evidence that of any political will anywhere? And obviously not in the Bush administration, unless I'm mistaken, but are you the opposition party, the Democratic Party?
I think they're dreadfully underinterested in this stuff. I mean, we had a State of the Union address and a follow-up Democratic response, and nobody mentioned once any of these issues. These are the real challenges of the 21st century. These are what we have to solve. And we don't even have legislation pending on most of this stuff. So I think Europe in some areas is slightly ahead of us, and this is why I'm cheering them getting together and becoming a stronger political force. But even that is not perfect.
Yeah, and they're ahead of us on the atmosphere as well. Julia Whitty, MotherJones.com, the article, The Fate of the Ocean. Check it out, my friends. Julia, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Great talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
No one knows what it's like to feel these feelings like I do. And I blame you.
And welcome back, my friends. Viagra for your brain. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. And no, it doesn't lead to rigid thinking. It's supposed to mean something else. I'm not sure what. Welcome back. Victoria Jones is with us with the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Victoria.
Well, hey, Tom. How are you?
I'm just great. But I'll get better. I suspect George W. isn't all that great, though. It seems like nothing's going right for this guy.
No, it's difficult. I mean, even as we speak, he's giving a speech which has gone on for, I would say, nearly an hour now. This is the second in a series of speeches that he had planned to talk about the war in Iraq, this being the third anniversary of the invasion of Iraq. In these speeches, he says that he will be what the purpose is, the White House is saying, is to explain to the American public better what we're doing and why we're doing it, and that, you know, that will help the public understand and get more support for the war.
Mm, You got to understand that there's bad guys over there, and we got to stop them there, because otherwise they might get on an airplane and come here.
Right, exactly. Yes, we've got to fight them over there so they don't fight us over here.
Mm, yeah, they can't chew gum and walk at the same time, you know.
Absolutely not. No, absolutely not.
Now, this is the third anniversary of our attack of Iraq. Is this being memorialized in any way in Congress and in Washington, D.C.? Do you see any sort of activity?
No. Congress is out. Congress is not in session.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it would memorialize it in any way, really, because you've got a House that is run by the Republicans and a Senate that's run by the Republicans. And now it would be incredibly politically charged, because so much would depend in the language of how it was to memorialize the invasion. So I think they're all probably quite glad they're in the districts this week.
Yeah. Dennis Kucinich recently on the floor of the House came right out and said the Bush administration was warned 9/11 was going to happen and ignored it. They were warned about Hurricane Katrina and ignored it. He said, what else might be coming that they're ignoring? He didn't raise the specter of bird flu. Is that being ignored?
Well, I have to say that the one issue that I've felt, and of course I don't know what could be done, but that I felt that the president seems to be on top of and seems to be engaged with and wanting to know what's going on with is bird flu.
Mm-hmm. Then why aren't they ordering huge quantities of, for example, rubber gloves and face masks? Because that, I mean, when we had the SARS epidemic, we know that a box of rubber gloves in Hong Kong went in price from, you know, 40 cents for a box of 100 of them, or maybe a dollar or something like that, up to as much as $100.
I don't know why they're not. I mean, I didn't know that was going to be effective against bird flu. Maybe it is.
Well, what people do is if they have to go to work, they have to go to the store, they put on rubber gloves, and, you know, then they can handle things and doorknobs and whatnot, and then when they get home, they take them off and throw them away.
Right.
And they wear masks. Well, that's what people did during the SARS epidemic. You know, it's just whether it will prevent you from ever getting it, you know, that's a whole other arguable thing. But certainly the SARS, I would think that there would be a lot of lessons we could learn from what happened when SARS was going around. The other thing is the airlines. I mean, the airlines are going to really, if this thing goes airborne, no pun intended, there's going to be a real problem for the airlines. And I wonder if there's any planning for that, because the airlines are not just a business. They're also part of our national security infrastructure.
Yes, indeed. And again, don't know the answer to that. Don't know the answer to very much here, apparently. But these are all of major concern, all of major concern, because we know that the birds are flying over. We know that it's going to come our way. I mean, it's almost inevitable, and are we ready for it, and is it transferring to humans, and if so, what does that mean? We're certainly not ready for an outbreak of flu.
Everybody
would concede that.
And they're setting up listening stations, monitoring stations in Alaska, thinking that's going to be the first place that migratory birds may bring it into the United States?
Yes, that's where they think, because that's the landmass-wise, that's the closest landmass to other landmass.
Sure. Now, Alaska is attached, by and large, to Canada. What's Canada doing about this?
I don't know the answer to that. I'm sorry, I'm so incompetent. I don't know the answer to that either.
No, you're brilliantly competent. You just don't have these particular answers. And I'm asking kind of some esoteric questions here. I'm going to have to do some research on this myself, because I have a feeling that Canada's getting their act
together. I hadn't thought about what Canada. They're usually fairly good on this kind of thing.
Yeah, and we might be able to learn some lessons from them, too.
And one would hope that there would be massive international cooperation.
Yeah. Massive what? I'm sorry.
You know, that thing where one country talks to another country without bombing it.
Oh, negotiations.
Yeah.
Is that what you said? I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I got a time cue over the top of you, and I didn't hear your word. I genuinely missed it.
Cooperation.
Yeah, there you go. Cooperation. Oh, that thing. George doesn't do that. You know, over the weekend, it just occurred to me, you know, plays well with others, you know, that grade in the United States in elementary school, first couple grades, first, second, third, plays well with others is one of the things that you get graded on. And I have a feeling that, you know, it's just not a good grade for George W.
I think you're probably right.
What else is happening in Washington, D.C. this weekend? We have just a half a minute or so.
Well, Senator Chuck Hagel on the Sunday show is being really very critical of the Bush policy in Iraq, saying, what is victory? We've gone there. We got rid of Saddam Hussein. We put a government in, and this policy that we've got right now is failing.
Right.
Very, very outspoken.
Yeah. Chuck Hagel, the former president of what is now ESNS, the voting machine company.
Is he really?
Yeah. He was the president of the company, and before that he'd worked 25 years for Bush Sr., And then he stepped down from being, and the company was headquartered in Nebraska. He sold the machines to the state of Nebraska, got it set up so that everybody in Nebraska voted on those machines, stepped down, ran for the Senate, and in an upset won even Republican and African-American communities that had never before gone Republican.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the place where smart people get their news. True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman radio program, 34 minutes past the hour. Dick Cheney this weekend talking with Bob Schieffer. On Face the Nation, I believe, is the program.
Mr. Vice President, do you believe that these optimistic statements may be one of the reasons that people seem to be more skeptical in this country about whether we ought to be in Iraq?
The optimistic statements, of course, being his quoting to Cheney saying 3 years ago, they're going to greet us as liberators, we'll be done with this thing in just a few weeks, blah-de-blah-de-blah.
No, I think it's has less to do with the statements we've made, which I think were basically accurate and reflect reality.
No, they were accurate. They reflect reality. Yep, that war, it only took 6 weeks, and they greet us as liberators, and they all love us, and it paid for itself, you know, out of the oil revenues, and all is well, and everybody's happy. Aren't you pleased? Aren't you pleased? I know I am. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Jeff in Colorado. Hey, Jeff in Denver. What's up, Jeff?
Hi, Tom. Fabulous show today. I just found that Boston Legal thing.
Yeah.
One thing that I make note of is a lot of people are waiting for someone else to rise up and do something.
Yeah.
Rather than themselves. And it's like, hey, every one of us has to do something.
Yeah.
Anyway, if you don't mind, I would call about the Mexican border, but Julia Whitty just is so important what she's talking about. I'd like to talk about that.
Sure.
First of all, God bless her. What she's talking about is one of the most important issues we have to deal with. And what I'd like to add is we're doing even worse with fresh water.
Mm.
Every time you flush anything down the toilet, it's going into the ocean. We're going to be affecting that, and almost everything is that. Like, I live in Colorado. What I do affects New Orleans.
Right.
And we're, like, our states right now, we're paying to have our states breed exotic species to put in the fresh water that in many cases, like, say, in Colorado, in other states, you'll find 75% of the species in the water are not native species. The native species are overwhelmingly endangered because of the fish we're introducing.
Now, this is really weird, Jeff. There was an article, an op-ed piece, might have been in the local Oregon paper here. It might have been one that I saw over the weekend. I traveled all this weekend. We went to Michigan and visited family. But it was the thrust of the article, and I think it was written by a conservative, was essentially that we are being nativists. We're discriminating against non-native species by saying that we want to get rid of them. And you know, what's wrong with a few non-native species after all? It was weird, but there's apparently a whole PR campaign about that out there.
Well, that's showing a basic lack of knowledge about ecosystems. And that, you know, we have millions of years of attaining balance in these things. And we have, you know, it's like we are also all of a sudden introducing things that we did not evolve around, that the ecosystems did not evolve around, and we don't know the consequences. So that's what's wrong, is we don't have no clue what the consequences are. And it's like these things are so much more complex than we ever realized they could be.
Hmm.
You know, any thread you pull, you know, and especially one thing people need to realize, like we're talking about climate change and so forth, is every change we make can instigate something called a positive feedback loop,
mm-hmm.
which means, like, you know, a small change may magnify into a, you know, global change because of positive feedback loops.
Oh, amazing.
And that can happen, you know, introducing exotic species. That can happen when the Arctic tundra melts and suddenly we have all this, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of miles of peat bogs suddenly that's rotting and giving off greenhouse gases.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, the same thing with introducing exotic species. You know, introducing the New Zealand snail. I don't know if you're aware of that one.
I'm not.
There's a little New Zealand snail, tiny, tiny thing that has gotten into American waterways. And the thing reproduces really rapidly and survives. It's got a really hard shell and survives through almost any type of trauma. And it's very much like the zebra mussel, which we have, you know, spreading all around. It ends up clogging up power plants, wastewater treatment plants, etc. I mean, these things are just getting everywhere.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. Jeff, thanks a lot for the call and for raising these issues, and I appreciate it. And it's great to hear from you.
Thanks.
And I got to ask the folks in New York to drop the call because I've lost my access to the call screening software, and it's telling me the system's down. So, but it's great to hear from you, Jeff. Former Prime Minister Iyad Alawi said, "Well, actually, before I tell you that, let me tell you what's leading up to it. In 2004, this is a year and a half ago, George W. Bush said." And I quote, "Well, Prime Minister Alawi was here. He's the leader of that country." He's talking about Iraq. "He's a brave, brave man. When he came after giving a speech to Congress, my opponent questioned his credibility." He's speaking about John Kerry. He said, "You can't change the dynamics on the ground if you've criticized the brave leader of Iraq." Okay. So now Alawi says, "It's unfortunate that we are in civil war. We are losing each day as many as an average 50 to 60 people throughout the country, if not more. If this is not civil war, then God knows what civil war is. We are in a terrible civil conflict now." And so now Bush is disavowing him. It's absolutely strange. I mean, it's just absolutely strange. 1-866-440-8466. Bonnie in Burgettstown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bonnie, what's on your mind today?
Oh, hi. I'm calling in regards to Mike, the gentleman who served our country in the Bosnian War.
Mm-hmm.
And he resented war protesters because they didn't protest against the Bosnian War, is what he said.
Yeah.
But that it just got little coverage by the corporate media. Who were blitzing us and penalizing us with Monica Lewinsky and Paul Jones. And that should be reported, but it shouldn't be 24/7. Mm. But I know groups like the Thomas Merton Center, who W is illegally wiretapping, not because they're terrorists, but because they disagree with W. But anyway, they protested at the federal building against the Bosnian War, and the print media reported those protests like on the local section B of the paper instead of the front page.
Mm-hmm.
And he needs to keep listening because he'll learn, Mike, that progressives have always criticized Bill Clinton, and you made mention of that to him. And we criticized Lyndon Johnson over the Gulf of Tonkin lie that got us into the Vietnam War. We criticized him then, and we still criticize him. And we
sure.
look at history. Not just American history, and we don't have that need to put presidents, regardless of the party affiliation, on a pedestal because they're mere humans and they can be corrupted. So no matter how much they profess to be religious or guided by their God or how much they tell us they're protecting us or freeing us, or freeing other people, you know, that's not a reason to abridge our civil rights and plunge us into never-ending war and into debt to make us, quote, free.
Yeah, I'm right there with you, Bonnie, and thank you for the comment, and I appreciate your calling. And in fact, I would say that probably most Americans agree with you and I in saying that to paraphrase the first Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, to say that there should be no criticism of the president is morally treasonous. Yeah, I think most Americans would agree with that, and that's why this latest Pew study that just came out last week. It showed that 48% of Americans, the 28% of Americans said something, they're when they thought of George W. Bush, they used words like Christian or conservative or, something that was perceived as positive. 48%, almost twice as many, 48% of Americans used words either idiot, incompetent, or liar. And I think that there will always be a small fringe, probably on both parties, who will be, hey, it's my president, right or wrong, no matter what he does, it's all fine. It seems to be more on the side of the Republicans, and I'm not sure why. I mean, there's some strange psychology there that I don't quite get, but in any case. Aiden in Spanaway, Washington. Hey, Aiden, welcome to the program.
Tom, I have so many things. Your program is so wonderful that I could sit here and talk all day, but I'm just calling regarding global warming. and things that I'm always concerned about, and that is, like, for example, the freight that is now being imposed on the oceans with respect to bringing all the stuff from Europe to here.
Mm-hmm.
And these freight ships must use an awful lot of gasoline or oil. I don't know what they use, but...
Yeah, it's mostly diesel oil.
You know, it must take an awful lot of heat to achieve that. And I really get the feeling that that might be adding to the global warming, all that heat that is imposed in the oceans. I also worry about the fact that one of these days, one of those freight ships is going to sink. And
I think a fair number of them already have, actually.
You're kidding.
No,
is
it's
that right?
Yeah. In fact, there are beaches. Sometimes in the California beaches, you walk along, and all of a sudden you'll see, you know, toys washing up. I mean, you know, there are little gadgets or gizmos or whatever. There's junk all over the ocean as a consequence of freighters that big freight ships that occasionally, rarely sink. More often, you know, they'll hit rough seas and they'll lose a few containers over the edge. But
I see. Yeah. Well, can they get those containers out?
What do you mean?
Well, if they sink in the ocean, can they
be
pulled out?
No, they, you know, they're miles and miles down. They very often they break up, you know, they corrode.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Because you know, like we're talking about dumping everything in the ocean. Everything gets dumped there.
Mm-hmm.
And my God, and then we're depending on the oceans for giving us food to eat.
Yep. Well said, Aiden.
Those two doesn't it make sense.
Yeah, exactly. Well said. There's a definite what's wrong with this picture to that. And I appreciate your calling and making that point. It's well said. I would also toss into the mix, by the way, while we're thinking of freighters on the ocean, airplanes in the sky. And, you know, that's something we need to be looking at as well. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
There are lives in the balance. There are people on the fire. There are children at the camp. There is blood on the wire.
If you haven't seen this thing, go to jacksonbrown.com or tomhartman.com and click up at the top for the link to the Jackson Brown video. It's absolutely incredible, this new video that's out. Welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. The place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination, or at least clean elections. Speaking of which, the former president of what is now ESNS Voting Machine Company, Chuck Hagel, the guy who sold the voting machines to the state of Nebraska, then ran from the state of Nebraska as senator, and surprise, won in what the Washington Post called the upset victory of the year. Fascinating. And now I have been predicting ever since this guy, he was a protege of George Bush Sr., by the way, part of the Bush dynasty for 20-some-odd years, worked for Bush Sr., and I've been suggesting for the better part of 4 years now that Chuck Hagel is going to be running for president someday. And in fact, Bob Fitrakis was the one who pointed out, he said, you know, we knew something was weird when in the primaries leading up to the 2000 election in New Hampshire, as I recall, suddenly George Bush Sr. was getting numbers that shouldn't have been gotten off electronic voting machines. And so anyhow, the voting machine guy, that's Chuck Hagel, and he's also, you know, a part of the Bush dynasty. In any case, he's speaking out against George Jr. This supports my theory that the whole reason why Jim Baker is being called to form a commission on this stuff is because the Bush dynasty is concerned about, you know, Jr. screwed it up again. He screwed up his own, Arbusto Oil Company. He's screwed up his other oil company. He's basically everything he's had any kind of management role in, he's screwed up. And the one thing where he just went along for the ride, the Texas Rangers, they bailed him in and they bailed him out, and he walked away with millions of dollars. But anyhow, here's Chuck Hagel, Senator Chuck Hagel, about the war.
So we have to start thinking about
He's talking with George. This is George Stephanopoulos, actually, starts this thing out. This is the ABC Sunday program.
So we have to start thinking about a staged withdrawal.
We always should be thinking about that. And this mindless kind of banner about, well, if we leave, the whole place falls apart. We can't leave. We can't even think about leaving. Wait a minute. Wait a minute. You just showed on your screen cost to the American people the last 3 years. It's helping bankrupt this country, by the way. We didn't think about any of that, not just the high cost of lives and the continuation of that, but our standing in the world. And I would define it this way. Are we better off today than we were 3 years ago? Is the Middle East more stable than it was 3 years ago? Absolutely not. It's more unstable.
So, interesting. And, you know, I guess just because the guy was the head of the voting machine company doesn't mean that he can't say something useful once in a while, but I consider it suspect, by and large. Colleen in Coos Bay, Oregon, KBBR. Hey, Colleen, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Hi. A faithful listener. I listen to you every day. I agree with everything. I did have another side of the story with the woman on the death of our oceans.
Mm-hmm.
I'm from Charleston, which is one of the last real fishing villages here in Oregon, and so know the side of the fishermen, which, you know, at this point on our coast, they are the endangered species. You know, we have so many restrictions on them. A lot of them make sense. A lot of them don't. A lot of times they send someone out from I don't want to say the government. I don't know who they're, you know, they go out on a boat. They go to one spot. They don't see one fish. So they say, oh, they're extinct. And where there's, you know, there's a big ocean out there. And I know there has to be.
Aren't we, Colleen, now correct me if I'm wrong on this. I thought I read this in the Oregonian, that we're down to about 140 family-owned fishing operations, commercial fishing operations, on the Oregon coast, whereas, you know, the vast majority of the fish that are pulled out of the ocean are pulled out of the ocean by a small handful of very, very large multinational corporations. Is that not correct?
That is correct. That is correct. But the small, you know, the last of the fishermen, which my son-in-law is a commercial fisherman, you know, from a fishing family,
right.
There's no salmon fleet anymore.
Yeah.
And
so what's happening is the small guys are getting wiped out by these giant commercial conglomerates that are basically raping the oceans.
They are. Exactly.
Yeah.
But one of the other problems is, like, we have no salmon season this year. And yet the sea lions, They're multiplying in the, you know, the thousands here on the coast because they are protected, and they eat tons of salmon every day.
Well, and they're a non-native species. They're from California. But my understanding is that the reason why here in Oregon and you over in Coos Bay, the reason why the salmon are not running the way they are and they're not the size that they should be is because in 2001, Carl Rove came out here and decided that Gordon Smith was having problems out on the east side of Oregon getting enough votes to get reelected in 2002, our Republican senator from Oregon. And so he diverted water from the Klamath River to the farmers to the point where the Klamath River didn't have enough flow to maintain a cold temperature, and hundreds of thousands of salmon that were going up to spawn died in 2002.
Right.
And so they never had babies, and those babies are not full-grown fish coming back this year. And so the main reason why we don't have salmon right now, or we won't have this season, is because Karl Rove made a political decision to help Gordon Smith.
Which is my point exactly. You know, the fishermen here, they don't want to deplete the oceans.
Sure.
You know, if they common sense tells you, you know, how things should go, they send people out who have no idea.
Yeah.
And, you know, that along with the seals and, it's a dying, we're dying here with the fishermen. And unless people just never want to eat fish again, which I love fish.
Seems healthy food. It's just amazing to me, though, that it's just like my friends in Michigan who are small family farmers. You know, they're wiped out by the big agribiz companies.
Right.
And it's these policies of, you know, Reagan, Bush, Clinton, and Bush of, you know, let's make it good for the big multinational corporations and to hell with the little guy.
Right, and it's been going on for many, many years here. I could tell you many stories about even just the loans they used to, you need a loan for a new engine, and then, we won't call it out. Oh, you didn't have a season this year? Well, you need to pay that. And they lost their money.
Yeah.
They lost their land.
Yeah.
They lost.
It's a tough business.
Forever, but,
yeah,
you know.
It's a tough business, Colleen, and it's the same with the farmers. It's the exact same thing. There's no real safety net there, and it's a tragedy. Colleen, thank you for the call, and thanks for listening on KBBR. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. This is incredible. This is absolutely incredible. Tom Hartman here with you, by the way, 6 minutes past the hour. George W. Bush just said, apparently on Faux News, and I quote, "First, just if I might correct a misperception, I don't think we ever said, at least I know I didn't say, that there was a direct connection between September the 11th and Saddam Hussein." Oh, really?
My fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
Now, let's see. Iraq has nothing to do with 9/11, Bush says.
The Battle of Iraq is one victory in a war on terror that began on September the 11th, 2001.
But now, he says, first, just if I might make a correction, I don't think we ever said, at least I know I didn't say, that there was a direct connection between September 11 and Saddam Hussein. Yeah, right. I think that there's a reason why when the Pew poll did their study, 48% of Americans, 2-1, over the number who used a positive word to describe George W. Bush, described him as either incompetent, idiot, or liar. And no, I realize it's very strong language. These are not my words. They did a random sample of American, average Americans, and said, what word comes to mind when you hear George W. Bush? And the 2-1 majority of Americans said either incompetent, idiot, or liar. And I have a feeling this has something to do with why. Alec Dubrow with the International Labor Communications Association on the line with us. Alec, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I actually like the response of the British public poll done a few years ago when they asked what they thought of George Bush, and the two words were stupid and incoherent.
Incoherent. Now, well, that's interesting. Well, of course, he must sound that way to them.
Well, that's part of it. Actually, Bush has gotten a little less incoherent over the years, but as you point out, when he starts being precise, he's in real trouble.
Well, you know, what's interesting, Alec, and the guy who first pointed this out was Mark Crispin Miller in his book, The Bush Dyslexicon. Mm-hmm. When George W. Bush talks about compassion, when he talks about positive functions of government, when he talks about helping people, when he talks about anything that's what we would consider positive emotions, he mangles his language. He's virtually incoherent. When he, however, is speaking of revenge, when he's talking about punishment, when he's talking about anger, and when he's talking about violence, he is absolutely articulate.
Kind of funny.
I think it's frankly kind of scary. The Bush Dyslexicon, Mark Crispin Miller's first book, was just a real eye-opener for me. It's frankly a shocking book. But let's talk about labor. ILCAonline.org, the website. It's .org, isn't it?
It certainly is.
Yeah, .org.
We're not a commercial enterprise.
There you go, ILCAonline.org. And what's happening in the labor field right now?
Well, the most interesting thing going on in the world right now is what's going on in France. And perhaps a number of Americans will say, how does that affect me? Well, it may or it may not, depending on how much attention you pay. It's been going on for several weeks. There's been building demonstrations and barricading of universities. And it was only picked up in the U.S. media when they could put the word violence in the headline. Mm-hmm. And that occurred during several large marches when groups of anarchists broke off and broke some windows and threw things. But basically, over this past weekend, between 500,000 and 1.5 million French people were in the street protesting a government-sponsored law. And this law, if you look at it narrowly, most Americans will say, what's a big deal? It's called the Contrat Premier Embauche, and it means the first hire contract. Under it, the government now says that employers can hire people under the age of 26 for 2 years, keep them for 2 years, and fire them at any point for no reason or any reason.
So this is sort of like the Taft-Hartley law provided for this option for people in those states that decided to opt into it, which was most of the southern states. And employment contracts went out the window, unionization went out the window, and you had the so-called right to work, right, which is a fancy way of saying right to fire. And because I know in most of Europe, I lived in and worked in Germany for a year, and I helped run an organization there. And if you wanted to fire somebody, you had to actually prove that you had a reason to do it.
That's correct. I mean, companies are not required to declare bankruptcy in order to fire them, but if they are, you know, if they lose money, they can lay off people. But otherwise, you can't just do it on a whim. You have to be fired for cause. Now, obviously, in any national, world, or continent-wide system, there are going to be, you know, anomalies, and some things aren't going to be right, and it's not perfect. Mm-hmm. But the French people, among other Europeans, have embraced this. What it's been building, because this government, the conservative government, has been attacking worker protections ever since they got in there. Now, put this in the context of Europe. I mean, many American workers would say, gee, that's not so bad. But people don't like to lose what they have.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for this, the timing of this particular thing, the CPE, as it's called, the first contract, it came about because of the riots in France last year by North African and African youths out of rage. So the government said, okay, we're going to get you all jobs. If you believe that cutting the benefits and the protections for workers is a way to address this problem, well, you're either lying or you're daft. I mean, lowering standards is not a way to combat endemic racism, and that's what those riots were about. Mm-hmm. You know, as you point out, in the south of the United States and most of the United States, employers can do pretty damn much whatever they please, and this has had no effect on the unemployment rate among inner-city youths. There's a story in the New York Times today that among young black men, particularly those with little education, the unemployment rate is enormous. It's well over 50%. So if racism is at the root of this, it's not going to help. In fact, it's quite the opposite. If you create a legalized pool of low-paid or easily fired workers, that tends to drive wages down.
Mm-hmm.
Slavery had the effect in the United States of lowering wages because employers could always turn to, or could often turn to, free labor.
Sure.
So the French are standing up for this. And it's interesting. Of course, France is a little different in the sense that the motto is liberty, fraternity, equality. Mm-hmm. Equality doesn't quite figure in the U.S. thing. And I've heard conservatives say, equality is for losers. Give me freedom.
Mm-hmm.
As if the two were utterly incompatible.
Right.
But it's
equality. The way that the French use the phrase equality is the way that we use the phrase in the Declaration of Independence. All men are created equal.
That's correct.
It means equal opportunity.
It is equal opportunity, not that each individual.
Which is a form of freedom.
I'm sorry.
Which is a form of freedom.
It is a form of freedom. It just reduces the leverage of privilege.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, and it's interesting that I was reading the responses to this on the BBC and on their website, and Americans and Britons were contemptuous of the French youths, calling them, you know, coddled because they want the same protections that their parents had.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we shall see, you know. It's interesting. I've been in touch with the AFL-CIO representative in Paris, and she said two out of three French back the students. I mean, the violence in it may turn away a number of people, but basically people do not want their protections undercut. And one person said, they were interviewing in the crowd, said, last week was announced that French multinationals had made a profit of 84 billion euros in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
Why should we have to sacrifice for this? And that's absolutely true.
Yeah. Although the same thing is happening in America. I mean, you have American multinationals making profits. Well, Walmart, $8 billion last year, and workers are sacrificing for it.
It's true. And I would like to see a response like this in the U.S., but so far we haven't seen it.
Yeah, well, we've been lulled to sleep, I'd say, between television and everything else. 10% of Americans taking prescription tranquilizers of some kind. It's incredible.
Well, wake up, Americans.
There you go. ILCAonline.org, Alec Dubrow. 16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
I'm just an old truth teller. I'm your candid friend. I'm not some daydream seller. I do not pretend.
Helping you win the water cooler wars, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 21 minutes past the hour. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466. If you'd like to drop into our live chat room, go to TomHartman.com and click live chat. Now, George, just, one more time, why did we go into Iraq?
The larger point is, and the fundamental question is, does Saddam Hussein have a weapons program? And the answer is absolutely. And we gave him a chance to allow the inspectors in, and he wouldn't let them in. And therefore, after a reasonable request, we decided to remove him from power along with other nations so as to make sure he was not a threat to the United States.
Oh, that's ridiculous. Of all the stupid suggestions.
yes.
We must also never forget the most vivid events of recent history. On September the 11th, 2001, America felt its vulnerability, even to threats that gather on the other side of the earth.
9/11, and that had to do with what?
First, some ask why Iraq is different from other countries or regimes that also have terrible weapons. While there are many dangers in the world, the threat from Iraq stands alone because it gathers the most serious dangers of our age in one place.
The danger of Iraq... Yeah, that's why we went in there.
If we know Saddam Hussein has dangerous weapons today...
Uh-huh, and we do.
And we do.
Uh-huh, yeah, uh-huh.
Does it make any sense for the world to wait to confront him as he grows even stronger and develops even more dangerous weapons?
Oh, no. We've got to attack this guy right away. Yeah.
This is a massive stockpile of biological weapons and is capable of killing millions. We know that the regime has produced thousands of tons of chemical agents.
Well, Rumsfeld sold it to
me. Including mustard gas, sarin nerve gas, VX nerve gas.
Well, my daddy sold that to him, Bush is saying, actually, but,
We've also discovered through intelligence that Iraq has a growing fleet of manned and unmanned aerial vehicles.
UDAs!
That could be used to disperse chemical or biological weapons across broad areas.
UDAs, model airplane!
We're concerned that Iraq is exploring ways of using these UAVs for missions targeting the United States.
Yeah, he's coming to get us. He's coming to get the United States. We got to take him out.
Iraq has attempted to purchase high-strength aluminum tubes and other equipment needed for gas centrifuges, which are used to enrich uranium for nuclear weapons.
Got
to
watch out for that equipment.
If the Iraqi regime is able to produce, buy, or steal an amount of highly enriched uranium a little larger than a single softball, it could have a nuclear weapon in less than a year.
Of course, they weren't getting it, and that's true of every country in the world, but still...
We've experienced the horror of September the 11th.
Oh, that again. I thought it had nothing to do with it.
We've seen that those who hate America are willing to crash airplanes into buildings full of innocent people.
Well, I hate American policies, anyway.
Our enemies would be no less willing. In fact, they would be eager to use biological or chemical or a nuclear weapon.
And that's why we had to go after Saddam 3 years ago today, don't you know?
facing clear evidence of peril. We cannot wait for the final proof, the smoking gun. It could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
No, can't wait. And we didn't. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, Alice in Humboldt County, California. Hey, Alice.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Alice.
I know you admire Al Gore.
I do.
He gave the most excellent talk last night.
Locally there in California?
It was, it was Channel 9.
Oh, it was on TV. Uh-huh.
And he was saying very clearly that Bush learned well in advance about 9-1-1 and did nothing.
I agree.
So many Democrats afraid to speak the truth about things. I was hoping that you would play some of the speech. It was a half-hour speech, and it had a punchline. People are waking up. And also the Republicans. I thought that was great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't see it, Alice.
You really missed a good one.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I have some pretty good lengthy clips from the last public speech he gave, and perhaps this is a replay of it. I'll look for him during the break.
It's just full of a lot of good things.
Yeah.
He also said, spoke directly about Bush knowing about Katrina in advance.
Now, Dennis Kucinich was talking about these things on the floor of the House of Representatives over the weekend, too. It must be something going around. These guys are all starting to speak out now.
Well, truth does come out, you know.
Yeah, it does, and it's a fine thing. Okay, Alice, thank you very much. Great to hear from you.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Always good to hear from you. Thank you for the calls. 27 minutes past the hour. Telling the truth that the multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know about, didn't think about, didn't even occur to you. Gee, there might be a multinational involved in all this. I'm Tom Hartman, 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
You want to win the game, you got to make the rules. We stole an election right in front of you fools. A terrorist system got you on your knees while we're picking your pockets and snatching your cheese. We got the USA by your curly short hair, so look out below, here comes the billionaire.
Oh, it's the billionaires for Bush.
The billionaires are in the White House. We're sucking your blood like a floating louse. Yeah, the billionaires are in the house. Enron is in the house.
In the White House.
Halliburton is in the house.
In the White House.
Fox News Corp is in the house.
In the White House.
ExxonMobil is in the house.
In the White House.
Philip Morris is in the house.
In the White House.
Monsanto is in the house.
In the White House.
This administration's preoccupation is directing the nation of wealth consolidation on the taxes that you pay. They'll be coming our way upon a platinum trace of all play. No one can stop us, no one dares. Run for the hills, here comes the billionaire.
Indeed, it's the billionaires for Bush. Look out, here they come. Welcome back. 35 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. In just a minute, we're going to be speaking with Gonzo Schechtschneider of BuzzFlash.com. First, a short clip from the Al Gore speech. I'm not sure if this is the speech that Alice saw or not. This is a speech from a few months ago that Al Gore gave. Actually, it was on 16th January of this year. And in this, he points out that when the founders created this nation, they didn't need to do away with the Bill of Rights, even though you had British troops on our soil. And when we were fighting the Soviet Union in the Cold War, they had 10,000 nuclear weapons. We didn't need to do away with the Constitution and with constitutional protections. But the Bush administration says that we're at war, even though we're not. There's no formal declaration of war. And they say that because of that, we're going to have to do away with the Bill of Rights. And Al Gore just does a brilliant job of laying this out.
Fear drives out reason. Fear suppresses the politics of discourse and opens the door to the politics of destruction. The founders of our country faced dire threats. If they failed in their endeavors, they would have been hung as traitors. The very existence of our country was at risk. Yet in the teeth of those dangers, they insisted on establishing the full Bill of Rights. Is our Congress today in more danger than were their predecessors when the British Army was marching on the Capitol? Is the world more dangerous than when we faced an ideological enemy with tens of thousands of nuclear missiles ready to be launched on a moment's notice to completely annihilate the country? It is simply an insult to those who came before us and sacrificed so much on our behalf to imply that we have more to be fearful of than they did.
Brilliant. Al Gore. Al Gore. The only president of the United States who was never president of the United States. Gonzo Schechtschneider is with us from BuzzFlash.com. Hey, Gonzo.
How you doing, Tom?
I am great, but I'll get better. Hey, Gonzo, what's in the news today? What are you guys over on BuzzFlash highlighting? What do you see at the top?
Well, obviously, it's Bush's perennial denial of what's going on in Iraq. His rose-colored glasses continue to get in the way of seeing reality for what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, we have an interesting Kirk Anderson sent us a cartoon. It's more of the president has no clothes theme. It's very interesting in relation to the Feingold Center, but also in relation to the whole Iraq war, you know, just the fact that they seem to be a disconnect from reality in the White House. And I'm sure it's probably intentional just to keep up the old resolute thing that he does so well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, or it could just be that he himself is disconnected from reality. I mean, it's just I have this... I've played this a couple of times today, but it's worth playing again. I'd love to get your take on this, Gonzo. Why you think George W. Bush said this? This was in a news conference, and really, you know, there's no percentage for him to be lying. I mean, he was just talking off the top of his head, and he was asked the question, you know, why did we invade Iraq? And here's what he said. Whoops. Oh, hang on just a second.
The larger point is. And the fundamental question is, does Saddam Hussein have a weapons program? And the answer is absolutely. And we gave him a chance to allow the inspectors in, and he wouldn't let them in.
What?
And therefore, after a reasonable request, we decided to remove him from power along with other nations so as to make sure he was not a threat to the United States.
Now, Chris Matthews the other day speculated out loud on TV that he's suffered alcoholic brain damage.
Yeah, it's possible. But, I agree with you in the sense that I don't think he's getting all the information. I mean, it's historically we've found out time and time again that he prefers to get his news boiled down into little bullet points on a single page of paper.
No, but he had to know that there were inspectors in Iraq. They were there for 3 months.
Before he threatened to blow them up if they didn't get out.
That's right. But he said Saddam Hussein would not let them in.
It defies reality. It really does. It befuddles me when you can't even comprehend that the guy who's running our country could be either so disconnected from reality that he doesn't understand what happened, or he's so disconnected from reality because his staff keeps him that way.
Yeah, or maybe we actually are dealing with somebody who's suffering from some sort of serious... I mean, here's another one, Gonzo. I'd love your take on this, because this has created a whole industry of conspiracy theories.
Well, Jordan, you're not going to believe what state I was in when I heard about the terrorist attack. I was in Florida. And my chief of staff, Andy Card... Well, actually, I was in a classroom talking about a reading program that works. And I was sitting outside the classroom waiting to go in, and I saw an airplane hit the tower the TV was obviously on, and I used to fly myself, and I said, well, there's one terrible pilot, and I said it must have been a horrible accident, but I was whisked off there. I didn't have much time to think about it. I was sitting in the classroom, and Andy Card, my chief of staff, was sitting over here, walked in and said, a second plane has hit the tower. America's under attack.
Now, nobody saw the first plane hit the tower until at least 25, 26 hours later, when a French tourist who just happened to be videotaping the tower was able to sell his videotape for some incredible pile of money.
Right.
We all saw the second plane hit the tower. But George is saying that he saw the first plane hit the tower while he was in Florida in a classroom.
Yeah.
Is he hallucinating?
I wish I could understand what was going on in his head, because I think he gets just a little bit of information and it sort of all gets mixed together. It's kind of like the stories your parents, the memories you have of like being a kid that are somehow modified by time.
They're not real memories. They're the memories of the stories that you've been told that become memories.
Right.
Yeah, there's a whole interesting field of psychology around that, how memory forms and how false memories form and accurate ones do. But I mean, this just seems to be a long pattern. He just basically kind of makes up stuff.
He does. It's routine. I think they just let him out there and they hope that he doesn't, you know, step on his tongue too much and take his foot out later on. And
yeah. Well, this is our best of the rest of the news segment for the week here, and our guest today, Gonzo Schechschneider of BuzzFlash.com. And Gonzo, let's get back to the best of the rest of the news. What, in overview, what are you seeing happening here across the United States that's of consequence?
Well, I think Feingold's censure is sort of like lit a very small pilot light under sort of the electorate, and I think it started in, you know, online and in certain Democratic circles, but I think that what he did was important to sort of get people talking about it. I saw Meet the Press or something, George Stephanopoulos this weekend, and George Will was like, you know, blowing it off as it's just for the blogosphere and a certain minor electorate and all that, but we've seen over the past, you know, couple of years, it's the blogosphere that's sort of like been at the lead of bringing to light issues that are routinely dropped by the mainstream media, and the fact that we continue to bring them up because of their importance ends up helping bring it to more people's attention. So I think the censure issue is going to come to play, especially in the 2006 elections, and as Democrats start vying for position for the presidency. So,
yeah. Well, there are calls now for there to actually be hearings on the censure issue, right?
Yeah, I don't know how much teeth that kind of stuff will have.
It was Pat Leahy and Jim Jeffords. I mean, a Democrat and a former Republican, but at least they came out and said it.
Yes, that's the key. We got to come out and start saying these things, despite what any of the people on the right have to say about it. I mean, who cares what they say? Because they're going to say the things that they think benefit them, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
The other stuff I think that's important to keep in mind, that the NSA spying issue is still a huge sort of like stick in people's back. It's just like gnawing away at people. And the fact that the U.S. News and World Report came out and said that Gonzalez pretty much denied, or he didn't deny, but he didn't say they weren't doing black bag jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of scary. And those kind of things are seeping into his Republican base.
I was amazed that the Sunday New York Times article about the torture operations that we were undertaking at the Baghdad airport, you know, and the No Blood, No Foul was the little logo that they were using, that story didn't get any broader coverage. I didn't, at least here in Oregon, the local papers didn't pick it up. I haven't seen it in any of the mainstream media. It was there and then it went away.
I don't understand it. The torture thing just kind of blows my mind. I went through interrogation training with the military. I was trained to be an interrogator for the U.S. Army, and I never actually practiced it. I never went to a war when I was in the service. But the fact that nowhere in my training did they ever mention torture as a possible means to get good information.
That's because it's ineffective.
It's about actionable intelligence.
There you go.
If people tell you something that they want you to, you think they want you want them to hear, they're not gonna. It's not gonna be useful.
That's right, and you got to have something that you can use in a court of law as well. Gonzo Schechschneider of BuzzFlash.com. Gonzo, thanks for being with us. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We honor and respect our troops and hold our flag up high. But please don't make them shed their blood for nothing but a lie.
Welcome back, my friends, for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. A bit of a clip from Boston Legal, the ABC drama. This is about a young woman named Melissa Hughes, as I recall, who refused to pay part of her income tax because it went to support the war in Iraq. And she's on trial for not paying her taxes.
Now, you might...
And this is her attorney.
Now, you might think, instead of withholding her taxes, she could have protested the old-fashioned way, made a placard and demonstrated at a presidential or vice presidential appearance. But we've lost the right to that as well. The Secret Service can now declare free speech zones to contain, control, and in effect, criminalize protest. Stop for a second and try to fathom that. At a presidential rally, parade, or appearance, if you have on a supportive t-shirt, you can be there. If you're wearing or carrying something in protest, you can be removed. This in the United States of America. This in the United States of America. Is Melissa Hughes the only one embarrassed?
I'm just amazed that the right-wing talk shows are not playing this clip. Well, obviously, but that they're not jumping all over ABC for this. I mean, you know, how dare ABC? What? Political.
And what I'm most sick and tired of is how every time somebody disagrees with how the government is running things, he or she is labeled un-American.
Evidently, it's speech time.
And speech in this country is free, you hack. Free for me, free for you, free for Melissa Hughes to stand up to her government and say, stick it.
Objection.
I object to government abusing its power to squash the constitutional freedoms of its citizenry. And God forbid anybody challenge it. They're smeared as being a heretic. Melissa Hughes is an American. Melissa Hughes is an American. Melissa Hughes is an American. Last night, I went to bed with a book. Not as much fun as a 29-year-old, but the book contained a speech by Adlai Stevenson. The year was 1952. He said, "The tragedy of our day is the climate of fear in which we live, and fear breeds repression. Too often, sinister threats to the Bill of Rights, to freedom of the mind, are concealed under the patriotic cloak of anti-communism. Today, it's the cloak of anti-terrorism." Stevenson also remarked, "It's far easier to fight for principles than to live up to them." I know we are all afraid, but the Bill of Rights, we have to live up to that. We simply must.
We simply must. From Boston Legal on ABC. Who would have thought? 1-866-440-8466, our phone number, Kathy in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening to WPTT. Hey, Kathy, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Boy, it's great to have you on the air in Pittsburgh. We really enjoy you here.
Well, thank you. I'm loving being there.
Well, you know, I participated in the march here in Pittsburgh over the weekend against the war with the Thomas Merton Center.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they filed suit against the FBI for illegally watching what they're doing over there.
Oh, I know, and they've gotten some pretty good information so far on this from the Freedom of Information Act filing.
Well, they had, at the march, you know, we could see the two FBI guys up on top of the building taking pictures of the whole crowd.
Oh, my.
And, of course, there was a helicopter that was hovering above the entire time.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we got to the end of the march at the recruitment center down here in our university town in Oakland, you know, the whole crowd was standing outside chanting to shut it down. And the police were all lined up in there with their riot gear, and they had the dogs out and everything. It was just really incredible.
How many folks showed up, do you think, Kathy?
Well, that's kind of the sort of pitiful thing to me. You know, we had 2,500 people, which was a fairly good turnout.
Sure.
But you may have heard in the national news a few weeks ago that when the Steelers won the Super Bowl here, we had 250,000, a quarter of a million people turn out in downtown Pittsburgh because the Steelers won the Super Bowl.
Well, that is a big deal. I mean, they're qualitatively different things. And as I opened this the very opening of the program, I was talking about how the New York Times was talking about how the protests all around the country were so much smaller than they were 3 years ago.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's because people are any less passionate.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's because it has ceased to shock us. In fact, the what used to be an us and them thing has become an all us thing.
Yeah.
In the early and mid 60s, if somebody had sideburns or long hair or whatever, it was, oh, look at them. They must be a hippie, you know, or inclined in that direction. By the 70s, it was fashionable.
Yeah.
And it just, you know, it ceased to shock and it just became the norm. I think that thinking that George Bush is either incompetent, a liar, or an idiot, the words from the Pew poll that 48% of Americans used,
mm-hmm.
and believing that this war is wrong, which all the polls show more than half of Americans believe, is just the norm. And so a lot of Americans have kind of become the silent majority now because they just figure, hey, you know, we're part of this whole thing.
Well, the greater percentage of the people in the march were actually, you know, I would say at least people over 40.
Mm-hmm.
There was a smaller percentage. There were some students there, which was great to see, but they were certainly the smaller percentage,
yeah.
I think.
A lot of us left over from the 60s here. We're yeah. still out there, Kathy.
Yeah,
Kathy,
plenty.
Thanks a lot for the call. It's
thanks.
Great to hear from
Bye-bye.
You. Jake in Arcata, California. Hey, Jake, we just have a few seconds left. What's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, I'd just like to ask all your listeners to please call the representatives and urge them to support Russ Feingold's resolution to censor the president. Clearly, the NSA spying program is illegal and unconstitutional, and the Republicans have no regard for our Constitution or the Fourth Amendment, and we have to hold Bush accountable for his illegal activities.
Well said, Jake. And the toll-free number to do that is 888-355-3588. You can call your member. You actually call your senators for Feingold's. Coming up on the next program, I'll be disagreeing with conservative Myron E. Bell from the Competitive Enterprise Institute on the administration's attempt to shoot down the Endangered Species Act. That and more, my friends. And don't forget, democracy, activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.